Thanking Lise Mollen and the Perimeter Institute for inviting me to participate in this wonderful conference. You know, I have to start by saying that I'm an economist, not a physicist, and so this is a very special treat for me because usually when I give talks to fellow economists or in some cases to practitioners, not to physicists and mathematicians. And so I should apologize in advance if I end up slipping into jargon or referring to any kind of inside economist jokes. In fact, the only joke that I know that would probably appeal to this audience is one that happened to me for real in graduate school. When I was in graduate school, I was sitting in a math course taught by a very well-known mathematician, Alex Grothendieck, and it was a course on algebraic number theory. And for weeks, we were doing theorem proof on prime numbers, and finally, most of us were totally lost, raised our hands and said, Professor Grothendieck, can you please give us an example of this prime number theorem? And he said, certainly, consider any prime number, let's say 15. Now, you know, when I first started teaching MBAs at the Wharton School, I was told by my colleagues, you should tell some jokes. And I told that joke and was greeted with total silence. So I'm very grateful that all of you laughed. But I wasn't asked to come here to tell jokes, but rather to talk about the economic crisis, and in particular, how the science of economics has been transformed or should be transformed by the events of the last couple of years. And I thought I would start by just pointing out that the science of economics is a rather contentious phrase in and of itself. There are a number of people that would argue that economics is not a science. I'm not one of them, but a number have, because for one thing, economics is not an experimental science, at least not in the macroscopic scale. And of course, we know that there are other examples like astronomy and cosmology that are sciences, and yet they're not easy to conduct experiments. Somebody else asked, how can economics be considered a science when two people can share a Nobel Prize for saying the opposite things? And this is in fact true. There was a case, Gunnar Myrdal and Friedrich von Hayek, that were at opposite ends of the political and economic spectrums that shared a Nobel Prize. So, you know, there is a certain degree of controversy, and what I want to do today in the half hour, 40 minutes, is to try to give you a sense of where that controversy has come from, and to talk about a specific example of that controversy having to do with financial markets, because financial markets really are at the core of this financial crisis. And I say that, you know, with a great deal of both humility as well as pride, in the sense that, the economic crisis is really more of a financial crisis. And so we really want to focus the attention on what's going on in financial markets. So I want to talk a bit about, first, how it is that economics came to be, what the underlying driving forces were, and as a result, I'm going to be less than rigorous in my comments. I'm really going to speak by way of analogy and storytelling, but ultimately, I hope to provide a little bit more rigor by talking a bit about how this applies in the context of financial markets, and to bring in some research from the cognitive neurosciences that might shed some light on behavior. Someone once said that along with rigor usually goes mortis, so I want to be careful not to spend too much time worrying about that. But at the same time, if you are interested in a more rigorous exposition, feel free to check out my website, and there are a number of papers there. So let me start by talking about the foundations of economics. And I'm going to talk about really how we came to be the field that we are today. And really, it goes back to the well-known economist Paul Samuelson. And before I tell you about Paul Samuelson, I have to explain that all economists, myself included, we suffer from a very particular psychological disorder known as physics envy. And actually, I'll disagree slightly with Emmanuel Derman's remarks about prediction, because I would argue that the reason that we all have physics envy is because economics, and in fact all human endeavor, is generally all about prediction. And it's the fact that physics is just uncannily good at making all sorts of predictions. The science of physics is extraordinarily successful, and it's turned into tremendous technologies precisely because it yields understanding of certain relationships that lead to predictions that actually work. We economists would love to have 3 laws that explain 99% of all behavior. We have 99 laws that explain maybe 3%. And as a result, when somebody like Paul Samuelson comes along and tries to put our house in order, we take it very seriously. In particular, in 1947, when Paul Samuelson was a graduate student at Harvard University in their economics department, he published a thesis, which he modestly titled The Foundations of Economic Analysis. Now, the sad part is that it was modest because it actually came out to be true. His thesis, his graduate PhD thesis, ended up becoming the underpinnings of most of neoclassical economics. And in 1998, Samuelson wrote a retrospective where he described what he was trying to accomplish in that foundations of economic analysis. And this is a direct quote from Samuelson. Perhaps the most relevant of all for the genesis of foundations, Edwin Bidwell Wilson was at Harvard. Wilson was the great Willard Gibbs' last and essentially only protege at Yale. He was a mathematician, a mathematical physicist, a mathematical statistician, a mathematical economist, a polymath who had done first-class work in many fields of natural and social sciences. I was perhaps his only disciple. I was vaccinated early to understand that economics and physics could share the same formal mathematical theorems. Euler's theorem on homogeneous functions, Weierstrass's theorems on constrained maxima, Jacobi determinant identities underlying Le Chatelier reactions, etc., while still not resting on the same empirical foundations and certainties. So this is Samuelson, the father of modern neoclassical economics, acknowledging that what he was trying to do, quite deliberately, was to pattern economics after physics. Now, Emmanuel mentioned this principle of least action, and that's another example of prediction, right? The idea that if you have a particle in a gravitational field and you want to predict its path, then what you ought to do is to make believe the particle is acting as if to minimize its action and compute that path through the calculus of variations. That's a prediction, and it works. And so Samuelson said, I'm going to do the same. I'm going to assume that individuals maximize utility, a concept that was developed literally 100 years earlier. I'm going to assume that individuals maximize utility subject to a budget constraint, and that will predict their path in economic space. And Samuelson argued with his critics who said, well, you know, what is this utility? Who knows what that is? Samuelson said it doesn't matter. Just as a particle doesn't know it's maximizing or minimizing action, an individual doesn't need to know that they're maximizing their utility if the theory is predictive. And through that process of this physicist's interpretation of economics, we had a number of tremendous breakthroughs in economic science, including utility theory, general equilibrium theory, game theory, rational expectations, option pricing theory, and the efficient markets hypothesis. Now, by the way, many of these ideas were recipients of Nobel Prizes. And I would argue that either directly or indirectly, all of these ideas were influenced by Samuelson's physicist's approach to economics. What I want to spend the next 10 or 15 minutes talking about is this last idea, efficient markets. This is an idea that was first developed jointly by Samuelson and Gene Fama independently. Fama puts it as financial market prices fully reflect all available information. That's what an efficient market does. And Paul Samuelson, in his paper on the same subject, it's titled Proof that properly anticipated prices fluctuate randomly. So we see a bit of this kind of theorem proof flavor that Emmanuel mentioned, and which I do believe is not particularly helpful in developing practical theories. But nevertheless, there it is. And I want to give you an illustration of the power of efficient markets, because it is one of the most important ideas in all of economic science. And to do that, I'm going to tell you about the research that was done maybe 5 years, 6 years ago by two economists, Michael Maloney and Harold Mahern, about a rather somber event, the Challenger explosion. Most of you, I suspect, recall on January 28, 1986, at 11:39 a.m., the space shuttle Challenger exploded shortly after takeoff. And I suspect that many of you remember exactly where you were when that happened. It was such a traumatic event for all of us. The news wires reported shortly thereafter, 11:47, space shuttle explodes. 12:17, Lockheed has no immediate comment. Lockheed was one of the major vendors that participated in the construction of the shuttle, as was Rockwell International, and they had no comment at 12:52 p.m. Now, I think most of you remember that President Reagan established a formal presidential commission to examine these events. Richard Feynman was on that panel and ultimately wrote a dissenting appendix to that presidential commission report. And it took him about 4.5 months to figure out what happened. And on June 9th, 1986, they issued the report, which identified Morton Thiokol as the weak link in this system. And in particular, it was that O-ring that ultimately was at fault. The O-ring apparently became inflexible because of sub-zero temperatures at the time of launch, releasing vapors that were ignited and ultimately caused the booster rocket to explode. Now, that took 4.5 months for a panel of scientists to figure out. What Mulhern and Maloney report is that this information was apparently reflected in stock market prices approximately 21 minutes after the explosion. Now, let me show you. These are the prices of the four vendors that had a participation in building the space shuttle: Morton Thiokol, Lockheed, Martin Marietta, Rockwell International. And you'll notice that these are the stock prices of their stock at 11:30 a.m., at noon, at 12:36, and at 1 o'clock. And if you compare the returns from 11:30 before the explosion occurred to noon after the explosion occurred, in that half-hour interval, it turns out that one stock had to have a trading halt because too many people were trying to sell that stock, and they couldn't process the transactions quick enough. That was at 12 o'clock on that day. Now, here's the price graph for the entire day, starting at 11:30, and all of the prices are normalized to be one. And although all the stocks were hit to some degree, the stock that experienced the largest percentage gain, and if I showed you a graph of the three-month graph beyond it, you would see very clearly that Morton Thiokol was identified by that end of that day in no uncertain terms. This is the power of efficient markets. A few years ago, James Sawicki, the journalist, wrote a book called The Wisdom of Crowds, and this is what he was talking about. Somehow, the information that took this blue ribbon panel 4.5 months to divine was reflected in market prices virtually instantaneously. And so, Gene Fama's dictum that prices fully reflect all available information is the powerful concept that has been driving much of financial markets and financial research since it was formulated in 1965. Now, there have been a number of critiques to this framework, and the critiques have come from psychologists and behavioral economists that have argued that, well, you know, this is one example, but there are many, many other examples of irrationality. And so while you argue that markets are rational in processing information, you also have to acknowledge that individuals do not behave rationally all the time. In fact, these cognitive scientists have documented behavioral biases like loss aversion, overconfidence, overreaction, herding, mental accounting. And a few years ago, I spent the summer reading this literature, and by the end, I was convinced that the human animal was the stupidest creature on earth. Because we all exhibit these biases. I guarantee you, all of you, you exhibit these biases. And since we're short on time, I won't go through all of them, but I want to show you one that will try to get the point across and illustrate the kind of cognitive limitations that all of us have hardwired into us. And to do that, I need to show you a video clip. I'm going to show you a 30-second video clip and ask you to engage in a relatively simple cognitive task. And I just want to illustrate to you how hard it is to engage in some very basic cognition because of your various kinds of behavioral biases. So this is a picture from the video clip where you're going to have students passing basketballs back and forth to each other. And the cognitive task I'm going to ask you to do is to count the number of times the basketball is passed from one white t-shirted student to another white t-shirted student. Only the white passes will count for the purpose of this exercise, okay? Now, you might ask, how hard could that be? Well, while you're doing it, I'm going to be saying random numbers out loud. And you know how annoying it is when you're trying to count and somebody else is counting with you? So it's going to be hard. You're going to have to concentrate. By the way, how many of you have already seen this? If you have, don't spoil it for the rest of the folks. All right? So here we go. Let me bring this video clip up and maximize it. And here we go. Now remember, only the white t-shirted basketball passes count. And so that's one, and that's two, and three, and five, six, seven, eight, six, nine, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, 17, 16, 18, 19, and we are almost done. Okay, how many people counted 16? 17, 18, 19. What, do we watch the same video? Is this anybody who hasn't seen this before see anything unusual? Yeah, what did you see? You saw a gorilla in this clip. How many people saw a gorilla in this clip? How many people did not see a gorilla? You did not see a gorilla. Would you be willing to testify under oath that you did not see a gorilla? Okay. All right, let me show you this again, and I promise there are no tricks, because obviously some of you did see something unusual. This time, don't count, just watch. And I think you'll see something rather interesting here. Not only was there a gorilla, but it stood in the middle of the frame and it beat its chest. Listen, you know, forget about the black swan. If you can't even see a black gorilla, you're in deep trouble. Now the purpose of this exercise was obviously to make the point that our cognitive faculties are finite. The human cognition facilities are extraordinarily finely tuned and well adapted to certain things, but it doesn't have infinite processing power. And when I asked you to focus on the white t-shirted passes, your brain worked quite well in filtering out everything else that wasn't white. That's why you didn't see the gorilla, many of you. And I give this example because it really demonstrates pretty clearly that we have to take into account human behavior in some very, very fundamental manner. Otherwise, we're missing a big piece of interactions between humans. And economists hate to be reminded of this because this is not physics. There's no equations that you can write down very easily that can incorporate this into a model. But the psychologists and the behavioralists have argued that this is important. And so they say that, how can you think that markets are efficient or that expectations are rational? Now, going back to Samuelson, interestingly enough, he recognized this. He recognized this in 1947. I'm going to read to you a passage from his thesis where he recognized the dangers of over-mathematizing certain economic interactions. So this is from his foundations, from his PhD thesis. Samuelson writes, "Only the smallest fraction of economic writings, theoretical and applied, has been concerned with the derivation of operationally meaningful theorems." Now, that's a pretty arrogant thing for a graduate student to write. But then again, you know, if it's the foundations of economic analysis, I guess he gets to say that. "In part, at least, this has been the result of the bad methodological preconceptions that economic laws, deduced from a priori assumptions, possessed rigor and validity independently of any empirical human behavior. But only a very few economists have gone so far as this. The majority would have been glad to enunciate meaningful theorems if any had occurred to them. In fact, the literature abounds with false generalization." So it wasn't as if Samuelson was under the delusion that economics was just like physics, and if only we could figure out Newton's three laws of finance, we're done. He recognized the limitations. The problem is that the generations of economists that came after Samuelson that weren't as smart as Samuelson took his approach and kept the look and feel of physical economics, but not necessarily the substance and value. And so I want to argue today that through this notion of efficient markets and how we model human behavior, we can come up with a better way of looking at financial interactions that aren't necessarily based on physical principles, but where we are just as scientific and where we borrow from biology and in particular from the cognitive neurosciences. Now, to do that, I have to beg your indulgence for a few more minutes and talk to you a little bit more about some of the recent advances in the neurosciences. And in particular, I'm going to tell you about a theory that was developed maybe about 15 years ago by a neuroscientist by the name of Paul MacLean. It's called the triune model of the brain. And I have to say at the outset that this theory has been discredited to some degree, not so much discredited, but rather we filled in a lot of blanks that weren't available just 15 years ago. So what I'm going to give you is a very rough and coarse approximation to what we now know about how cognitive processes work. But nevertheless, it's instructive for thinking about how to incorporate some of these ideas into economics. So MacLean's idea was that the brain is not nearly the homogeneous organ that we all think it is, but rather it's comprised of different components, three in particular, hence the name triune model. The first component is what MacLean called the reptilian brain. It's the brain stem, the part that sits on top of your spinal cord. And it turns out that the reason that MacLean calls this the reptilian brain is that this is the part of the brain that we share with virtually all vertebrates. And it's the part of the brain that, from an evolutionary perspective, is the oldest. It also controls the most basic bodily functions, things like heartbeat, breathing, temperature regulation, things that we can't control unless we're Zen Sufi masters. Okay? Now, the second part of the brain that MacLean identifies is what's often called the midbrain, and what MacLean calls the mammalian brain. It's the set of organs that sit right on top of that brain stem. And it turns out that the mammalian brain is called that because this is the part that we share only with warm-blooded creatures, with mammals. And it also turns out that neuroscientists have documented that certain emotional functions, fear, greed, sexual attraction, those kinds of things are controlled by various different components of that mammalian brain. Now, you might ask, how do neuroscientists know this? Well, many of you, I suspect, are familiar with the fact that if you take a subject and put them in an MRI machine, and you take not just a picture, but a series of pictures, in other words, a movie, you can actually see the flow of blood because blood contains iron, and iron shows up on an MRI scan. So neuroscientists take a subject, put them in the magnet, and they engage in various different kinds of stimuli. They take a needle, and they stick the subject with it. And the subject says, ow, and all of a sudden, a part of the brain the middle part of the brain lights up. Some part, with that then can be identified as the pain center of the brain. So mammals share this particular part of the anatomy with us. And with responses like fear and greed, they are triggered in this particular area. And frankly, emotional responses of all sort are seated in the midbrain. And that's one of the reasons why mammals actually make better pets than reptiles. We talk about, warm and fuzzy creatures. We tend to be more sympathetic to them because they can actually exhibit emotions of a sort that we find sympathetic, whereas reptiles really don't. The last part of the brain that MacLean identified is what we actually think of as the brain. It's that gray matter, the curly coils, which actually aren't coils at all, but rather it's a layer that sits on top of the midbrain, about the size of a dinner napkin, and five business cards thick. This part of the brain is what MacLean called the hominid brain. This is the part that Homo sapiens and certain great apes have. And typically, using MRI scans, they've been able to identify that the sort of higher thought functions are seated in this hominid brain. Things like language ability, mathematical reasoning, those are really part of that hominid brain structure. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is because it turns out that neuroscientists have actually shown that these three components can work independently in some circumstances, cooperatively in others, and antagonistically in still other circumstances. And so the situation that I'd like you to imagine is if you were in a car accident, God forbid, and you're bleeding out and going into shock, your body begins to shut down. It turns out that your brain will start shutting down too. But these three components shut down in a very specific order. They don't all shut down at once. And so, just out of curiosity, let me ask you, which of these three components do you think shuts down last? Which do you think has the highest priority? Of course, the reptilian brain, because that controls basic survival functions like heartbeat and breathing. If that shuts down, it's pretty much over. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why you can lose consciousness but still be breathing. You can faint. Now, of the remaining two components, the mammalian brain and the hominid brain, which do you think has priority there? Which do you think shuts down first, the hominid brain or the mammalian brain? Not so sure. It turns out that the mammalian brain has higher priority than the hominid brain. And so the hominid brain actually shuts down first. And the way to see that intuitively is that if you're being charged by a saber-toothed tiger, it's more important for you to be scared and run like hell than for you to be able to solve differential equations. Even if you're from MIT. And from an evolutionary perspective, the hominid brain is newer, and so it's not at all inconsistent with that kind of priority. Under great emotional stress, the mammalian brain has priority. And now, neuroscientists have documented this, and you might ask, well, how do they do that? If you take a subject and put them in an MRI machine and show them a mirror on the top of it so they can see a computer screen, and you let their hands move freely so they can control a key press or a mouse, you can have the subject solve simple math problems while they're in the MRI. And while they're doing that, you stick them with a needle. And they go, ow, and then it takes longer for them to solve those math problems. Now you might say, gee, you need an NSF grant to figure that out. You know, I think I could have told you that if somebody's trying to stab you, it will take you longer to solve math problems. But here's the amazing thing. They found out that the increased time it took to solve the math problems, that lasted hours after that pinprick. Not seconds or minutes, but hours later, you were physiologically impaired in the sense that the flow of blood was actually constricted to the hominid brain in favor of your midbrain. And it lasted for hours. And those of you who question this, you can probably come up with your own real life experiences that would verify this. For example, if you've ever tried to meet a very attractive individual to ask them out on a date, you may have constructed a very elaborate scheme to meet them by accident. And then after you meet them, you're going to ask them out. You're going to impress them with something that will make them want to go out with you. And after you get this all set up, you finally run into them by accident. And the moment you open your mouth, you sound like a complete and utter idiot. You say all the wrong things. Well, there's a reason for that. It's because strong sexual attraction stimulates your mammalian brain. That restricts the flow of blood to your neocortex. Love makes you stupid. And if you don't believe that, we're going to do a little we'll do a little demonstration here, okay? The demonstration is this. I'm going to ask you to read out loud, to say out loud with me the colors of the words that you see displayed on the screen. I don't want you to read it. I want you to just say out loud the colors as quickly as you can from left to right, okay? Ready? All right, red, green, blue, yellow, orange, blue, brown, red, green, purple, pink, black, blue. Great. No problem, right? Easy. I'm going to do the same thing now. Ready? Okay. Blue, red, green, black. What's, come on. Hey, why so slow? The reason that in this case it took you a little bit longer to do the task is because in the previous case, the color and the word were in sync. But in this case, they contradicted each other, and it took your brains a split second longer to adjudicate that conflict. color recognition is part of the mammalian brain. It's very ancient. In fact, any of you who've ever decorated a dining room, you'll know that interior decorators usually tell you, oh, paint the walls red, because red is an appetizing color. Do you ever wonder why red is an appetizing color? Can you guess? Yeah, exactly. The color of blood. On the other hand, word recognition is part of the neocortex, the hominid brain. And so when the two are in sync, no problem, you can do it quickly. But when they disagree, it takes you a little bit longer to adjudicate that. So the point of this example is that what we model as the utility function or preferences is really the confluence of all of the various different brain components that give rise to a choice. And this is a gross oversimplification, but nevertheless, it goes to the point that emotional response and logical deliberation have to work in tandem to produce behavior and choice. And if we don't recognize that kind of interaction, we end up missing out on a very important piece of economic interactions. And physicists, you don't have to worry about this, because you don't have emotion affecting the things that you're studying. You don't have this kind of dynamic. So I would argue that physics is inherently a simpler set of issues. Not that it's simple, but it's simpler than economic interactions to model. So the conclusion of this particular perspective is that, first of all, it's pretty clear that agents don't have rational expectations. We do not make decisions by computing mathematical expectations and optimizations, but also that it's not completely up in the air either. In other words, there is a way that we can quantify and understand in a somewhat more fundamental way what the underpinnings of behavior are, and that's through some of the recent advances in the cognitive neurosciences. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. Let me now turn to what this implies for economics. So on the one hand, we have efficient markets, which is, I have to say, a wonderful marketing success, because who wouldn't want to be efficient, right? That's a wonderful name. On the other hand, we have behavioral or irrational kind of finance, where individuals are engaged in a variety of psychologically motivated types of actions. What I want to propose is a synthesis of these two ideas, which, for lack of a better term, I call the adaptive markets hypothesis. And really, there are just five main ideas in this hypothesis. Notice I don't call it a theory. It is a hypothesis. The first is that individuals act in their own self-interest. I don't think economists would argue with that. There's not much debate there. But starting with points 2 and 5, economists would have a strong disagreement with these particular principles, which is that individuals, they make mistakes. They don't optimize subject to budget constraints and infinite computing resources. In fact, they engage in what an economist by the name of Herbert Simon called satisficing decades ago. Simon proposed that individuals have limited ability to compute. They have bounded rationality. And so they don't optimize, they satisfice. And as a result, individuals, they develop rules of thumb for behavior. And these rules of thumb are obtained from learning and from adaptation. Competition drives adaptation and innovation. And ultimately, it's the principles of evolution that determine market dynamics. And I don't mean this as a metaphor. I don't mean this as an example. I mean this literally, that the principles of evolution apply just to financial and economic transactions as they do to anything else. And by the way, this is certainly not a new idea. E.O. Wilson was among the first to point out that the principles of natural selection apply to social systems as well as biological ones. Now, let me give you an example of adaptive markets at work, a concrete example. And this has to do with the efficient markets hypothesis. We're going to come back to that. One of the implications of efficient markets under certain specific conditions is that price changes of financial assets have to be uncorrelated through time. In other words, prices have to follow random walks. Because if they didn't, if there were predictabilities in price changes, then someone could make use of that and do slightly better than somebody else, and therefore, by that action, make prices random yet again. So this idea of the random walk hypothesis is very much tied to efficient markets. And therefore, if we look at the historical behavior of stock prices, we ought to see in an efficient market that there is virtually no autocorrelation, no correlation or predictability between past price changes and future price changes. So let's take a look at what that correlation is. This graph uses the S&P Composite Index from January of 1871 to March of 2009, monthly data, to compute a rolling window, five-year rolling window, first order autocorrelation. So for every 60 months, I'm going to take those 60 data points and compute the correlation between this month's return and the previous month's return, right? Very simple calculation. And under the random walk hypothesis, that should be zero. Well, it's not zero, but it's not just not zero. It actually fluctuates. So the blue bar graph is the autocorrelation. And you can see that during certain periods of the early 1890s and the turn of the century, the market was very efficient. During the early 20s, the market was very inefficient, high serial correlation, high predictability. During the mid-50s, efficient again. During the 80s and 90s, inefficient. And during the most recent period, it was more efficient, and now it's looking less efficient, not surprisingly. And by the way, this blue line here is, on a logarithmic scale, the growth of the S&P composite, the stock market index, over that period of time. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. The adaptive markets hypothesis is something that can explain this phenomenon where the efficient markets hypothesis cannot. If you look at this, you would say, I reject efficiency. But that's not the right conclusion, in my opinion. Let me tell you a story about this. Now, we're still in the land of storytelling because there are a number of approximations that I'm making and lack of rigor. But here's the story. In the 1920s, the go-go era, there were lots and lots of people investing in the stock market and lots of brokers trying to get investors to leverage up. At that point, there was no limit on the amount of margining you could do. And so if you model individuals as these little round circles with arrows showing their view of whether markets are going to go up or down, you have a situation in the 1920s where lots of people are participating in the stock market, and they're all very, very optimistic about what's going on. They all have the same views. They all have the same views. This is not the wisdom of crowds. This is the madness of crowds. When everybody starts thinking the exact same way, that's when trouble happens. And I'm going to come back to that idea in a little while. Now, what happened? Well, we know what happened. We had the Great Depression. And by the way, if you take a look at, on a logarithmic scale, the decline in the stock market from here to here, that actually is much, much larger in percentage terms than what we've just experienced. Not that, you know, what we've experienced was a small thing. Okay. The 1950s was a period of relative efficiency, and I would argue during that period, you do have the wisdom of crowds. You don't have a single opinion. You have lots of different individuals with different opinions, and more importantly, they're all engaged in some kind of information gathering activities. And that's how the wisdom of crowds reflects itself. That's how we were able to figure out 30 minutes after the space shuttle exploded that Morton Thiokol was like the likely culprit. It was because somebody in their wisdom incorporated their views into the market price. And not everybody was thinking in the exact same way. In the 1980s and 90s, those of you who were engaged in day trading, I bet you there are some people in the audience that did do that. You know that that was a period where, again, lots of optimism and lots of very, very common perspectives. And then, of course, if you look down at the chasm after that, you notice something interesting, which is that there was a tremendous decrease in the correlation in the late 90s and in the early 2000 year. Now, what happened there was that not only did we have a correction in the tech bubble, but something else happened. What happened was algorithmic trading, and that's the square blocks. You have a new species that had arisen in the 80s and 90s, including D.E. Shaw Prediction Company and a number of other very, very prominent hedge funds. And where we are today, of course, is right over here at this edge where the autocorrelation over the past year or so has spiked up yet again. because now all of us are driven not by greed, but by fear. And we all think things are going down. The madness of crowds versus the wisdom of crowds. So the one aspect that I want to comment on regarding this behavioral argument is probably its weakest link. And that is, it's fine to say that individuals behave in a way that is not optimal, but they come up with heuristics. But the question is, where do these heuristics come from then? And Herbert Simon was roundly criticized for his notion of satisficing because the economists at the time argued that if you can come up with a solution that is satisfactory and you're willing to live with it, how do you know that it's satisfactory unless you do the optimization and figure out how far you are from optimal? And unfortunately, he didn't have a good response, but I think I do. And I'm going to illustrate that response with a very simple example. The example has to do with a problem that I have to deal with every day, and I suspect all of you do, which is getting dressed in the morning. And in order for me to tell you how I solve that problem, I have to tell you what my wardrobe looks like. So here we go. I have 5 jackets, 10 pairs of pants, 20 ties, 10 shirts, 10 pairs of socks, 4 pairs of shoes, and 5 belts. Now, you might say that's a rather limited wardrobe. But if you do the combinatorics, you'll see that that gives me 2 million unique outfits. Now, granted, not all of these outfits are equally compelling from a fashion perspective. So I've got an optimization problem on my hands. I have to figure out what outfit to wear in order for me to speak before you this afternoon to be the most compelling I can be. And that's a problem. So suppose that it takes me 1 second to evaluate the fashion content of each outfit. How long would it take for me to get dressed in the morning? Well, the answer is 23.1 days. Now, obviously, I get dressed a lot more quickly than that. And the question is how? How on earth did I develop the heuristic to get dressed in the morning? And I'll share with you a formative experience that I had that'll give you some hint as to how I developed my algorithm. When I was 6 years old, growing up in New York City, superhero of the day was Superman. There was a TV show, comic book, and some clever marketing genius figured out that if you took a Superman emblem and stuck it on a jacket, you can sell a lot of these things to kids. And, you know, growing up in a single-parent household, we didn't have a lot of extra money, and so, you know, at first my mother was absolutely resistant. She would not buy me the jacket, but like any other good, persistent six-year-old, I nagged her for weeks on end, until finally she gave in. So I still remember the day, Friday night, we went to Alexander's, bought the jacket, I spent most of the weekend wearing it, I slept with it, and come Monday morning, I got up extra early, got in front of the mirror, paraded around in front of the mirror with the jacket just to see how I looked, and I was so impressed with myself and the jacket that I was 15 minutes late for school. And in those days, you needed a note from your parents if you're going to be late, so I had to get my mom give me a note, went to the class, walked to the very front of the room, gave this note to my teacher, and all the other kids were sort of in their seats already snickering at me because I was late, and I sheepishly walked to the back of the room. And you know that it must have been a traumatic event if 43 years later I can still remember it to this day. And you know what? From that day on, it never, ever took me more than 5 minutes to get dressed. I changed my heuristic because of a very strong emotional response. And this is really where Simon, I think, stops and where evolutionary theory takes over. The answer to how do heuristics come about and how do we know when something is good enough? The answer to that critique is, we don't. We don't know. It's by trial and error. And if it turns out that it's not good enough, meaning we get negative feedback and it feels really bad, we're going to come up with a new heuristic. And so heuristics evolve, just as individuals, species, and other biological entities. So now, with that framework in mind, let me turn to the financial crisis in my last few minutes. The financial crisis, I think all of you have heard a lot about. I'm not going to repeat it here. The bottom line is that we overleveraged the housing market. It was a bubble, and when it crashed, it brought down a lot of financial institutions. And the question that I want to leave you with is, how could this have happened to us, the most sophisticated financial center of the world? How could it have happened? And you know, shortly after the financial crisis occurred, CNN came up with this a Hall of Shame, where they featured Dick Fold and you know, other culprits of the crisis. And I'm glad that they stopped it after a couple of weeks, because my guess is that they stopped it because they had too many people that were in this Hall of Shame, and they just couldn't fit any more. Because if you sat and did a serious analysis of who should belong in that Hall of Shame, it's all of us. Not just the bad investment bankers, not just the credit rating agencies, not just the regulators. All of us, we're all complicit. And this leads me to the conjecture that human behavior is in fact the culprit. Now, let me turn to disaster in other industries to make the point. And here are scenes from the Space Shuttle Challenger, Columbia, Chernobyl, the Minnesota Bridge collapse, Three Mile Island. And in all of these technology-based industries, the question is, why does disaster happen? And in 1984, a sociologist by the name of Charles Perrow came up with a theory about this. He called it the theory of normal accidents. That was the title of his book. What he observed was that in all of these industries, accidents happen all the time. And they happen, in his view, when two conditions are met. And I've added a third. The two conditions are complex systems, nonlinearities, and tight coupling. The third condition that I would add to that is an extended period with an absence of negative feedback. Because it turns out that in all of these cases, the weak link is not technology, but the ability for humans to responsibly use that technology. Three Mile Island happened not because of E equal MC squared. We shouldn't be blaming the formula. We ought to be thinking about how we use that technology. So it's not surprising that in 2008, Reinhart and Rogoff, two economists, wrote a paper where they demonstrated that since 1974, there have been 18 national-level banking crises around the world. And in the majority of these crises, you have the exact same conditions that happen here: rising housing prices, rising stock market, large capital inflows, large amount of public debt, and large financial liberalization. Sound familiar? And I want to leave you with the following thought experiment. The thought experiment is, suppose that in 2005, you knew for a fact that the real estate market was going to blow up, and you knew that we were heading for disaster. Now, that thought experiment is not as unrealistic as you might think, because here's an article in the New York Times about some work that I had done with one of my students, where we demonstrated in the hedge fund industry that the hedge fund industry was heading for a major dislocation that was likely to have broad repercussions. And so the question is, if in 2005 you knew this, and you were the chief risk officer of, let's say, Lehman Brothers, what would you have done about it? What could you have done about it? Well, you might have told the CEO, we have to get out of this business. We've made a lot of money, but in fact, you know, it's time to go, because within the next 2 or 3 years, the party's going to be over. And he would have looked at you and said, let me get this right. You want to shut down the unit that's been the most profitable for the last 8 years, that has accounted for the majority of your bonus as well as mine, that is the envy of the industry. You want us to do what? Not going to happen. Suppose you said to him, okay, let's cut the risk by half. Well, he would say to you, okay, you want to cut the risk by half, which means we're going to get half the revenues, which means the very best people in this group that are already thinking about leaving to start their own hedge fund and taking half of our clients with them, they're going to leave now for sure, and we're going to lose that part of the business where everybody else is trying to build up the business. Our shareholders are going to go nuts. We can't do that. And finally, if you were to say, okay, fine, do what you like, but as chief risk officer, I'm going to hedge against this major disaster. I'm going to take positions in opposite to where the firm is going, just so I can balance out this kind of a risk. First of all, I don't know of any chief risk officer that actually has that authority, but if you did, you know what would have happened? You would have lost tremendous amounts of money for the firm in 2005, 2006, and the first part of 2007, where you would have been fired long before then for losing that money. Chuck Prince said it best, the former CEO of Citigroup: when the music is playing, you got to dance. It is virtually impossible to time these kinds of markets. And if you are the lone rational voice in an otherwise insane world, you are the one with the problem. And so I want to conclude by saying that financial crisis is unavoidable. It's really the confluence of human behavior and free enterprise. If you're willing to get rid of either one of those, you can get rid of crisis. But that's not to say that we can't do anything about it. In fact, I would argue that the disruptive effects of crisis is not that people lose money. People have been losing money since there was money. The disruptive part about crisis is when the wrong people lose money. And by wrong people, I don't just mean me or you. I mean that people who are not prepared to lose money. So people like money market funds or banks or insurance companies that were not well prepared for those losses. And there's a lot that we can actually do to prepare for this kind of crisis. Hurricanes cannot be eliminated. You can't legislate them away. They're a force of nature. But you can reduce the damages of hurricanes by preparing for them. And so these are some of the proposals that I and others have made. You can read more about that on our website. But I would argue that we are in an extraordinarily important time right now, because only during periods of crisis is there the political capital, will, and momentum that will allow us to change things for the better. And so hopefully with all of your help and with better science, not worse, we can actually do that. Thank you.
Now we have a coffee break that will run till 4:30.